Welcome to Stack Trace, episode number 90. We're going into the 90s, Rambo, and it's really exciting. This is right after WWDC. We have a lot of things to talk about, so many things that we don't even have time to say the tagline of this podcast. So I'm just going to jump straight in and say, how are you, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great here. I'm from the 90s, so I'm quite happy about this milestone.
Yeah, this podcast is soon going to be as old as you, or no, maybe that's not how it works out. Yeah. Maybe in podcast years, maybe one podcast year is 1 week, just like how dog years are different than human years.
I never thought about that. That actually makes sense. There is such a thing as podcast years.
Maybe there is.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to after this whole week last week where we talked every single day on the WWDC by Sindel and Friends podcast, which was a lot of fun. So how was your weekend? And have you been kind of, you know, distilling some of the information from last week?
You know, right after DubDub usually happens, it didn't happen as much last year because there weren't as many like fundamental changes, but I'm now kind of like rethinking everything in my projects. I want to have a different user interface for AirBuddy in Big Sur. Like the one I have, it doesn't look bad in Big Sur, but it definitely doesn't look like it was made for Big Sur. So I'm thinking about that. And I'm also thinking about Chibi Studio on iPad. I spent last morning like designing a new, completely new user interface for Chibi Studio and playing around with it. So yeah, I think I'm setting myself up for a lot of work. We'll see.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah,
it's interesting because that sidebar change on the iPad, like the fact now that a lot of system apps on the iPad have that sidebar instead of using a tab bar or a navigation bar as their primary navigation. It might seem like a subtle change, you know, on the surface level, but like you say, it really forces you to kind of rethink a lot of things. And when I first saw that, I was like, oh, the hamburger menu is back. Because, you know, when you have that collapse, the sidebar collapse, it kind of looks like a hamburger menu.
Yeah.
But it is pretty different in that it's kind of supposed to be there all the time and then you can collapse it when needed. So it's kind of an inverse hamburger menu if you want. So, I feel like a lot of apps are going to kind of use this opportunity to rethink their structure and their overall navigation.
Yeah, and I have a fear of split views because my experience using split views on both the Mac and on iOS hasn't been the best, like in terms of developer experience. But they did do some things to split views in iOS 14 that seem to improve them a lot in how you can use them. I was watching a session and there was one thing that kind of made me worry in terms of because when you run an iPad app, you can have it as this really narrow column when you use it with another app side by side. And in that case, you're supposed to transition into your more iPhone-like UI. And the way split views handle that has always it never really made sense to me, and the way they were describing how you handle that in the session, I was like, this doesn't look really, it looks like it's going to cause some issues. So yeah, but we'll see. I'm saying this based on what I've seen, but I haven't actually implemented it, so yeah, we'll see how I'll feel like after actually writing some code.
Yeah, I was playing around with this new API together with SwiftUI's new outline groups and the lazy vGrid as well. And I even built a little proof of concept or prototype of a Swift by Sindel client. So Basically a app that you can use to browse my website. And it's pretty interesting because I wrote a plugin a while back that enables you to take your published website content and actually generate an API from it statically. And we used part of that plugin on the WWDC website so that you could then feed that into your WWDC app. Like it's a whole ecosystem here of apps and stuff like that. Yeah. Super cool. And this came a lot in handy here because I could just generate a static JSON file that I could then just use for prototyping. So I could just take that JSON file and instead of loading it over the network, I could just put it inside of this app prototype and then write SwiftUI code to render it. And that was such a nice workflow, just to have that mock data, which is real data in there, and then just to be able to quickly, using these more high-level constructs now in SwiftUI, these grids and outline groups, to be able to really, really quickly like build a menu and the grid and everything. And at the end of the day, I just had like 100 lines of code for rendering the entire prototype, which is quite remarkable.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's one thing I love about SwiftUI, of course. And something that happened at this year's WWDC is that I became even more excited about SwiftUI. I am actually looking forward to using it in production now. And of course, it's still going to be limited for those running iOS 13 or later, or running Catalina or later. But I see some opportunities where I can use it. I'm not going to say much now, but I think you actually mentioned a little bit about it in your latest article on Swift by Sandel, which is about how you can use it for things that are only available in the latest OS, such as app clips and widgets, which actually for widgets, you don't have a choice. You have to use SwiftUI.
Right.
But I think that's a really good approach. And I'm also looking at Apple Watch, because I think that's a place where SwiftUI is orders of magnitude better than what you had before with WatchKit. So I'm looking into those areas specifically.
Yeah, the Watch OS specific thing there, that's something that David Smith has mentioned quite a few times. I talked to him also on the podcast a while back, and he also mentioned that he really, really loved using SwiftUI on the Watch just because it's such a huge upgrade over the previous WatchKit. So I think with new technologies like these, it's not that you have to dive in and say it's an all or nothing kind of proposition. You don't have to convert your entire app. You don't have to start a new project. You can start kind of piecemeal, and you can either start with new features. You can build internal tools. You can build on one platform. You can maybe like build a watch app if you didn't have a watch app before, or if you have something like most of your data lives in the cloud or on a server, you could try building something like a lightweight Mac app for it. Like, there are so many different opportunities I feel here to take. And I feel like I'm just getting a little bit tired of the whole, like, is SwiftUI production ready? Because it all depends on the context, right? And of course, like, if you're going to write a super large scale app with lots of custom UI, lots of really complex navigation, maybe SwiftUI is not going to cover all of those things just yet, because it's a very new framework. But that doesn't mean that it's not useful. Like, you can start small with it, and you can grow into it, and you can learn where the limitations are currently, because there are limitations, of course. And it's just all about, like, how do you kind of ease your way into it? Because with the system widgets, where developers are required to use SwiftUI to build their user interface, I think Apple is sending a pretty clear signal that SwiftUI is here to stay.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, it's not going to replace UIKit or AppKit, which have decades of history behind them, in 1 year. Like, that doesn't happen.
No.
It's going to take a really long time, and that's fine. Like, it evolves. And I think this year we've had a lot of good additions. And also, the fact that it didn't break previous projects was amazing. Like, they promised source compatibility, and it's there. So I'm really happy with how they're doing this. And I played around with the new animation stuff, and it's amazing. I love it.
Feels like it was made for Rambo.
Oh, yeah. Made for Rambo. Trademark.
Somehow, I doubt that they're going to put that like as a tagline in the keynote.
I don't think so. But yeah, one can hope.
Exactly. So what about the new animations are you in particular excited about?
It's just that I love animations. Ding. I think that could be a ding in our show when I say that.
Yeah,
I love animations.
It's kind of like John Syracuse and his file system. It's you and animations.
We do have one for Air Power, though. So
that's right. Yeah. That's right. We do.
But so I love animations, and I don't mind writing the code to make animations happen in, quote, the old way. I mean, I do some pretty crazy animations in AppKit, and some people think I'm crazy because I do that, but I do it. But being able to create slick UI with nice animations without spending 50 hours working on your animation is quite nice. I like it. I like when I can have the same result with less work, of course. So that's basically what I love about SwiftUI, is that it just makes it easier. And you can focus on actually tweaking your animation and being creative instead of, oh, this auto layout thing doesn't work the way I expected it to, so I'll have to change my animation. Like, I was, I actually tweeted a simple thing I made, and I used the Xcode previews in iOS 14, which now I know how they work, thanks to your latest podcast.
Really
recommended. And I was tweaking, like, oh, what if I change the opacity from 0.5 to 0.6? And it's instant. Like, I think they did something special, and I think they actually mentioned it in your podcast, that when you change something that's, like, just a value, it's basically instant. It doesn't have to recompile your code or anything like that. So I was changing values, opacities, blur radius or radii, and changing other properties of my views to, like, actually get the animation just as I wanted it to. And it was amazing. Yeah, I almost cried.
Yeah, the iteration speed is just phenomenal. And the podcast episode that you're referring to there is the latest episode, as we record now, of Swift by Sundell, where I had the true pleasure of being joined once again by Josh Schaffer from Apple, and also by Eliza Block, who has been working on those Xcode previews. And like you mentioned, she went into a lot of detail as to how they're implemented. And it was so interesting to hear. And the fact that they are, like, hot replacing your code, they are basically just compiling that function that you are operating in and then replacing that method implementation on the fly without having to recompile the app. And also how they, like, replaced Springboard with, like, this system shell app that is, like, a proxy. Like, we don't want to spoil too much, of course, if you haven't listened to this episode yet, but let's just say it's super interesting. And the lengths that they are going to give that nice experience for developers, like, where there's that instant feeling, like you just said, like, where there's not this jarring animation where, like, your app is closing, then it's opening again, and you can kind of see through the covers, like, that is so Apple. Mm-hmm. And I really, really love that. Like, I really love when someone goes to those extra lengths to make something not just work, not just be a capable tool, but just look and feel really, really nice.
Yeah, and I think there's a learning opportunity here for everyone. And this is what I mean when I say that when you're working in a project, you should think about the experience you want people to have and then work towards that instead of seeing what you can do and doing that. Because if you do it the second way, you're always going to be providing, like, the minimum or, like, the quote best effort. But you should always strive for, okay, how do I want this to work? I want it to work like this. And work towards that, no matter how difficult it might be. But that, I think that's how you achieve great user experience. And in this case, great developer experience, which is a theme of this year's DubDub, even though they don't talk about that much in the keynote because it's not mainly for developers or it's not just for developers. But I feel like my experience as a developer has improved a lot with this year's releases. I've been working using Xcode 12. It's really good. Like, it's a lot faster than 11 for a lot of things. And also the documentation has improved a lot.
Oh, yeah.
The sessions were much better. So, yeah, I feel great as a developer right now.
Yeah, I feel especially this year, like, it feels like Apple has kind of tweaked their approach a little bit where, not always, but sometimes during previous years, I felt like with the developer tools, they felt this need to kind of wow us with cool features, right?
Yeah.
Where it was like, look at this folding animation in Xcode when you can do a string replacement, right? And it was like, yeah, it's cool. It looks nice, but, you know, you just want the string replacement. And with this year's release, there's just been so much kind of like flattening out of rough edges and speed improvements. And rather than doing something like a super elaborate tutorial or something, they're just like, let's just document everything. You know, let's just actually make things that people can use every day when they're working on these things, like small kind of quality of life improvements across the board. And that really adds up a lot. Like, I feel the same way as you, like when I'm working now with Xcode 12, and this is the first beta, you know?
Yeah.
Like some years, the first beta of Xcode has been like crashing every time you open it.
Yeah.
But now it's like, it feels great. Like it feels much better than Xcode 11. And I'm just so impressed by the work that all these teams have been doing in the middle of a pandemic, by the way, to really like create something really stable, really nice, and to really focus on the core developer day-to-day experience, which I think is super nice.
Yeah, I opened the JobbyJob project for the first time in Xcode 12 this morning, and I was expecting to like have to change a bunch of stuff and maybe not even be able to compile, and I had just one build error, which I fixed super quickly, and it now builds. And incremental builds are way faster, even for a super complex project with lots of targets and lots of dependencies. So yeah, really happy with it, especially considering that it's the first beta.
Yeah, I feel like also a lot of these things are kind of a culmination of a lot of work that they have been doing over many years. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the new build system.
Yeah.
Like when that was first introduced, it was a new build system. It was brand new. So, of course, it had issues, right? There were things they maybe hadn't considered, or they hadn't implemented them yet, or there were just bugs in there. Like any new software.
Yeah.
But now, a few years later, it's been maturing. They've had a lot of time to kind of, you know, polish it and make it really rock solid. And that coming together with all of these new changes and, you know, improvements to autocomplete and all those kind of things, it feels like, again, it's like a lot of small changes. I know they're not small, like building a new build system is not small, but, you know, all these different things coming together really just makes for a better whole. And yeah, it's really, really cool.
Absolutely.
Cool. So now let's start diving into the keynote again, because like we mentioned on the previous episode, we didn't have time to talk about the whole keynote because there was so many things. And of course, we're not just going to talk about the keynote itself, because now that's, you know, it's been a week since the keynote. It feels like it's been like 2 months because we've been doing so much work and there's been so much happening. But there was just a week since the keynote, more or less. But we still want to kind of continue going through all the major topics and just, you know, comment on them, talk a little bit about them. And we're going to kick it off by talking about privacy. And I feel like this year, Apple took a perhaps even stronger stance on privacy than previous years. I mean, they've been on this journey now for a while to kind of, you know, improve privacy and to really emphasize it for developers. But now it feels like kind of the gloves are coming off. Like it feels like rather than just like doing small incremental, like, you know, we're going to maybe require certain permissions for this API, or we're going to remove this particular identifier that people were using for tracking. But this year, they're doing things like showing what an app actually does on the App Store in terms of privacy. They're requiring developers to submit like these self-reports. They're showing what trackers that have been blocked in Safari. Like, it feels like it's a little bit more, like it's taking a big step forward in terms of exposing users to privacy implications. Or what do you think, Grandpa?
I think shame is a great tool for change. Yeah. Remember when they added battery shaming to macOS and then
yep.
developers started caring about not using power like crazy, like you have a nuclear power plant in your Mac? So yeah, I think this is awesome, and it's great that they're doing these things. Like, you can open a website in Safari. I think it was the New York Times or something like that, which had like 40 something trackers that were blocked by Safari. Of course, your website and my blog had zero because we have zero. But
yep.
even then, like, there are many websites out there which have like Google Analytics or something like that. And yeah, now it's that center right in the navigation bar, and users are going to see that and they're going to wonder, why is this here? Like, why does your website have all of this? And I think this shaming is a way to make web developers start caring more about this.
Yeah, and I saw a couple of interesting reactions to this online, which was people were kind of surprised that Google Analytics is seen as a tracker. And I also get the feeling that a lot of developers, especially people who are maybe not full-time web developers, like if they're just setting up a blog or just a website for their app or something like that, There's this feeling, I feel like, that Google Analytics in particular is like a some standard that you just should add, right?
Yeah.
That is like, if I want to have analytics on my website, and you might think to yourself, like, you might not even have some concrete use case for this analytic information, but you just want to know how many people visited your site.
Just something you do, right?
Right. It's just something you do. Like, you feel like it's something you should add to your site so you can know how many people visited it.
It's a tradition.
But Google Analytics is 100% a tracker. It's kind of like when you're using Google Analytics, and I don't want to kind of like make this too much of a big deal or something, but this is how I look at it. You are handing your users' data to Google in exchange for analytics. That's the transaction, mm-hmm. right? Because you're not paying for it. Your users are not paying for it. Well, they are with their data, but you're like kind of doing that trade.
Yeah.
And I would really encourage a lot of developers to, if you're not already, like start taking this really seriously and to try to really think about the implications of doing something like this, where when you're just bringing in some arbitrary JavaScript from, you know, especially an advertising company like Google or other people who have interests in tracking users, they are often tracking users through that. And you are bringing in external code that can then run on your website, do things to your users, track them, without you kind of having anything to do about it. And that's something that I hope will come out of this, is that there will be this kind of awakening both among users and developers and people running websites, that sometimes you might want to have a tracker for some reasons. I mean, I don't agree with those reasons, but you know, there might be use cases where you feel like you need to track people. But a lot of websites, I feel like they don't need this kind of tracking analytics, that they don't need that at all. So hopefully it will just lead to less tracking on the web in general.
Yeah, you mentioned paying with your users' data, and I think that's the key here. And in my opinion, that's too expensive just to get like how many page views you had. And there are better ways to do it if what you really want is page views and maybe unique visitors, such as using Cloudflare, which both of us use on our websites. And it gives you great analytics. Like, you don't get like the beautiful graphics or the breakdown per page that you get with something like Google Analytics. But if you want to know how many people visit your website each month or each day or whatever, you get that. And you even get like information about which countries they are from, which is aggregates based on IP address. So it's completely anonymous. So I think you should be using something like that, like a back-end solution.
Yeah, I agree, of course, because I also do the same thing. And I also agree that it's not a trade worth making for me. I don't even feel like it's my role or I have even the rights to make that decision. Yeah. Like, that's why I feel like I have such a strong stance on privacy, is that I feel like it's the user's choice. And now with all these features, like adding that transparency and showing upfront what trackers are being used on each website, users will have a much better choice. They can choose which websites they want to visit, which websites they want to read, if they care about their privacy. And I personally, I'm always going to try whatever I can to opt for the most private solution. And you mentioned Cloudflare there, like Cloudflare's analytics, and that's also what I use, and I think it's great. And it doesn't give you like how many people are on your website right now, or, you know, like you said, like really breakdowns of like, here's how old we think your users are, or here's what we think their income is. Like, I don't care. Like, you know, I just care about, is my website doing okay? Like, am I going down in terms of traffic or am I going up? And I know that using server-side analytics is not as precise as using on the client side. Well, that might actually change now, because if Safari is going to start blocking all of Google Analytics, then maybe server-side analytics is actually going to be more accurate. But again, I don't care. It doesn't matter so much for me. Where I think a lot of people who host websites, like I mentioned, they don't need as finely grained analytics. They just want to see how their website is doing, just like I do and you do. So I really hope that this is kind of enlightening a lot of people about what's going on with these trackers, and hopefully people can make some more informed decisions going forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So with that in mind, and we should also mention that we talked a lot more about some of these other privacy implications on an episode of our WWC podcast with our friend Anastasia Vojtova, which we'll leave a link to in the show notes. But let's talk about home. A lot of things in your home, right, Rambo? What's going on in your home?
In my home?
Yeah. Do you have HomeKit in your home?
My fridge broke yesterday. That's what's going on in my home.
Now you can get a new one powered by HomeKit.
Hell no. So my policy as to smart home devices is as follows. I'll only buy smart home devices from like credible and very well-known brands such as Philips or Logitech or something like that. Those are not the only ones. I'm just naming some examples. So I won't buy like some random no-name brands HomeKit stuff from whatever because I don't trust that stuff. And also nothing critical. Like I don't have smart locks or doorbell or anything that's like critical or that would have a really serious privacy implication if something bad happened. So nothing like that. A privacy or security implication. But I do have like my entire apartment is lit mainly by Philips Hue lights.
All right.
So anything that improves HomeKit or the HomeKit experience for me is gonna make me very happy. And one of the features that I really like is the adaptive lightning. It's a cable.
That would be a cool feature.
Yeah, it sends you lightning bolts to your home adaptively.
Yeah, I don't know actually if I would want that feature.
Yeah, the adaptive lighting for light bulbs. So I think this is going to require a firmware update for the light bulbs, which sounds kind of freaky.
Yeah, like, I was just going to say, that sounds absolutely crazy. Like, go back 30 years and tell someone that I'm just going to do a software update on my light bulb.
Yeah. I mean, even 10 years, I think that would sound crazy.
Yeah, or even 2 years. Yeah.
So anyway, that's the world we live in right now. So the gist is that it's like, what is it called? True Tone? Night shift.
Right.
It's like night shift for lights. And that could be a pitch for a VC funded startup right there. So yeah, I like it. I think it's cool. I currently have a custom scene that I have set up for my apartment when it's like 8:30 p.m. or around 9 p.m. I turn it on and it makes everything warmer. The lighting gets warmer, so that's, yeah, it makes me more sleepy.
Nice. Yeah, I also really liked seeing this adaptive lighting feature. It looked really, really nice. And also like the changes and improvements they've been making to getting a better overview of your devices. And I also really thought that the security camera improvements looked pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a security camera, but you know, being able to see who's outside the door and then do the face recognition, so it will say like, you know, your friend is at the door, like, and the fact also that they used like face data from photos to kind of populate that machine learning program. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really, really cool. Like, I feel like what they're doing here is really like advancing the smart home, like slowly but steadily in a way. Like you mentioned, you don't want to go and buy these like maybe cutting edge products made by companies that you don't recognize. This is kind of the opposite of that. This is like not maybe doing like the super crazy cutting edge things with your HomeKit devices, but it's kind of like adding nice features every year.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else that's really cool is that if you are using those cameras, you can now set up zones inside of the video frame that you care about, because it might be facing like a road or something, and then a car goes by and then your thing goes off on your iPhone. There's someone at your door. So I think that's really nice so that you can nail down like that perfect spot where you want to be notified when there's someone there. I think that's really, really cool. And of course, the face recognition is also really cool. But what I find really cool about this is also going back to our previous topic, all of the privacy aspect, because everyone does facial recognition and facial tracking these days. That's easy. That's a solved problem, mostly. But the really cool thing about this is doing it in a way that doesn't require Apple to like upload a live stream of your front porch to the iCloud to like do recognition, and then there's some server farm somewhere collecting hundreds of thousands of hours of video from people's front porches, which is what other companies do, which I won't name you here. But yeah, and also like there have been stories of companies who have smart home cameras sharing feeds of those cameras with law enforcement and things like that, which is a cool idea on the surface, but yeah, not so good when your users don't know it's happening and they don't have a say on whether it happens with their cameras. So I think Apple's doing the right thing. All processing is done on your home with your HomePod or your Apple TV, your home hub device. So yeah, thumbs up for that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And speaking of the Apple TV, so I have an interesting question here for you, Rambo. So this year, I think marks like the third or maybe even fourth year. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like many years in a row now where the Apple TV hasn't really seen any significant big new features or big updates. And I realize that that might be unfair because they have been adding things. But what I'm talking about here is that if you compare the changes to tvOS to the other platforms, even the watch, which this year saw no kind of huge changes, but still kind of incremental new features here and there and pretty cool things new added. But with Apple TV, it feels like it's not really moving very fast. So my question to you is, do you feel like tvOS as it is today is kind of along for the ride? Do you feel that they're going to keep evolving it as a software platform? Or if they're just going to say, well, let's pretty much go back to what we had before, which is just where there was these kind of like XML-based apps for streaming video, which is pretty much, it feels like what all the major Apple TV apps are doing anyway.
I don't agree that it's just along for the ride. I think, yeah, definitely it gets way less stuff than the other systems do, but it also doesn't need much.
Yeah, but that's kind of my point. Like, yeah, if it doesn't need to be like a capable software ecosystem platform thing.
Yeah, but like last year it got multiple users. That was a huge thing. Like, imagine the work that went into it. I think.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying that no one is working on it. That's why, you know, I wanted to preface that by saying, like, I know that there are changes and I know that there are people working on
there that. There is so. A tvOS team at Apple, believe it or not.
Right, right. So if someone listening to this is working on the Apple TV, I'm not saying that you're not doing your work. But what I'm saying is that all of these features that have been added, I don't feel like they require the Apple TV to be a software ecosystem. Like, you could add multiple users and still have the kind of XML-based app that they had before, maybe with some different integration with the third parties and stuff like that. Because this hasn't changed that, you know, all the different providers like Amazon and Netflix and HBO and stuff, they still have their own login system. They still have their own user switcher. So I kind of feel like there are cool features being added, but I'm not sure about the whole story around like tvOS as an SDK and things like that. Like, it feels like that is kind of year by year becoming less and less relevant.
Yeah, I think we're talking about different things here. Yeah, of course, they could close the tvOS App Store and the world would be mostly fine, I think.
Yeah.
And you could come like with a YouTube app and a Netflix app and that would be it, or all the other services. But like two of my wish list items for Apple TV were done this year, which were picture in picture, finally, because it was ridiculous that tvOS didn't have picture in picture. You're going to be able to stream YouTube in 4K on the Apple TV, finally, as well. So I'm very happy with how tvOS is doing. The main thing that I'm still missing from Apple TV is support for handoff, which
yeah,
I still don't get it. Like, why it doesn't have handoff? Like, John, they should just implement handoff.
It's just a Boolean, right?
Yeah.
Is handoff enabled? True.
So I don't know what the technical limitations are that prevent them from implementing handoff, but that's like the main thing that's missing for me. But of course, all of the major players, YouTube, Netflix, whatever, they pretty much make like a cross-platform Frankenstein monstrosity app that runs on TV sets, like the Samsung TV I have here. The YouTube app on my Samsung TV and the Apple TV is pretty much the same. Like, it looks and feels almost the same. Actually, the Samsung one is a little bit better because they messed up the tvOS one. But yeah, I don't disagree.
Yeah, and I feel like that kind of proves my point, right? Like, I get it. Like, I totally get it. Both from Apple's perspective and third parties, it's kind of like a vicious circle at this point where since there hasn't been a kind of flourishing app ecosystem on the Apple TV yet, it kind of makes it so that other platforms become higher of a priority for companies like YouTube and other video providers, especially like integrating directly into TVs where there's no kind of gatekeeper. There's no, you have to get a second box. You just have it in your TV. And that in turn probably makes this less of a priority for Apple as well to add features like handoff and things like that and to like make it on par with the other platforms. Because of course, like if you only have a certain number of engineers and you're going to decide, you know, how do we spend our time? Do we spend it on the next version of iOS or tvOS? Like the choice is pretty clear at this point, right?
Yeah.
So I totally get it, but it's just like kind of it begs the question of like, you know, if this was just kind of like a, here is a video player app that Apple provides, and then you can kind of theme it and you can add your own features to it and you can decide like what content comes from where, kind of like CarPlay, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking that maybe it would even be better here.
Yeah, but at the same time, like I run apps on my Apple TV that are apps and not video players. Well, you're going to laugh at this. I use the speed test app on my Apple TV to test the speed of my internet. How are they going to do that with XML, John? Explain it.
I can implement that in XSLT, no problem. Awesome. So yeah, Apple TV, interesting. Let's see where it goes.
It's still a product in our lineup.
It is still a product in the lineup. But you know, I should also say I use my Apple TV every day. So this what I was saying here is not a criticism to Apple TV as a platform. I'm just, you know, thinking about what the future
just
might
wondering.
Hold. Yeah, just wondering. But now let's talk about a platform that got a lot of changes this year, and that's macOS. And of course, there are two big sides to the changes going into the Mac this year. We both got a huge kind of change on the software side with macOS Big Sur and also Apple Silicon. So Rambo, let's phrase it like this. Which one of these two are you the most excited about? The opportunities that Big Sur presents itself with the new design language, or Apple Silicon?
It's like asking me to pick a favorite child. That's
right. It's good that you don't have any children.
Yeah.
So.
I think what gets me excited the most about the future of the Mac is the Apple Silicon transition, definitely.
Yeah, I agree as well. I think it is going to have a huge impact on the Mac as a platform, you know, long term. And I also felt like with them showing all these demos and showing this iPad processor running macOS and performing so incredibly well, it just got me really excited to see what is this going to look like once they have a completely custom system on a chip running macOS.
Yeah, and the phrase people are using is like, they're not even trying right now with this
right, exactly.
A12Z. It's like, just take the chip from the iPad Pro and stick it in a Mac Mini so developers can try things out. And that's really what they've done. And it's not even trying. So yeah, it's incredible to imagine what's going to happen when they release Macs that have a chip that's been made for the Mac. And we shouldn't, but we have benchmarks of the DTK. It even running Geekbench under Rosetta 2 emulation, I think it's performing better than like the Microsoft Surface whatever something under yeah. Rosetta. And yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's the whole like emulation story as well is incredibly impressive. And this is funny because a lot of people, and I would even count myself in that group, didn't even think that Apple would do any emulation at all this
Same.
Time, right?
Yeah.
Because it feels like that's kind of been their playbook for the past couple of years has been, let's kind of leave the legacy behind. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. Like, it's just two different approaches. But here they've really gone above and beyond to say like, no, like it's going to be exactly the same as before. Like we have this super fast emulation. We can run iPhone and iPad apps as well on the Mac now. We have this developer transition kit and people can, for the most part, kind of just compile their app and it just works. Like it feels like they've really, really done everything in their power to make this as smooth of a transition as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And given that it's going to take a while, like they mentioned 2 years, it could be longer, could potentially be shorter as well. But there are going to be Intel Macs around for a long time still. And yeah, developers don't necessarily have the bandwidth to do the universal stuff, even though it's really simple for most apps. I think they're doing the right thing. And if you are using like an app that hasn't been updated in a long time and it's not being developed anymore, you're going to be able to use it for the foreseeable future. I think that I don't remember how long the original Rosetta lasted, but I think they removed it in like Leopard, right? So it took some time, or maybe it was even later than that they removed it.
Yeah, it's also like 32-bit apps, right? Was also around for a long time, even after it was announced that they announced it and then they deprecated it and then they removed it, right? So it is a transition and it's going to be a transition. And I also feel like I hope it's going to go smooth and it feels like all the places are in place for it to go smooth. So I'm just really excited about this in general. I'm excited that it kind of breathes new life into the Mac in so many different senses, like with the new version of macOS, with the new design language, with the Apple Silicon, and also like that it is in many ways moving the iPad and the iPhone and the Mac kind of closer together when it comes to the underlying technologies, when it comes to the design language. And there's still going to be like unique platforms with pros and cons and that are kind of designed for different purposes. But the fact that there's going to be so much kind of underlying technology sharing now, just even more than it's been before, I'm really excited about that. So at this point in the recording, we actually had to stop recording for about 2 days because it turns out that Rambo's little mention of adaptive lightning actually summoned a lightning storm. Is that right, Rambo?
That is correct. We had a little bit of a situation here, which was not funny, but fortunately everything is fine. I'm fine. Nothing happened to me. But yeah, there was like a huge storm with super strong winds. And I only noticed it when the power went out, basically.
Right.
Because I was using my noise-canceling headphones and I was recording with you and like my internet connection died and I was just like, oh, this ISP. And I just switched to my 4G and we kept recording. And then, yeah, you'll hear it. I'll include that blooper reel at the end of the episode. It's quite funny.
Awesome. Yeah, it was like us trying to establish where the problem was. So like, is the internet connection a problem? Is it the recording itself? Or it just turned out that it sounded almost like the world was ending outside mm-hmm. of your window, which I guess was quite scary. And yeah, it's good to hear that you're okay and it seems like everything is okay under the circumstances. But these like extreme weather conditions, when they happen, can be really, really scary.
Yeah, fortunately, it's all fine now. It's mostly just a few bits and bobs that have been broken, but we can fix those.
That's good. So, Rambo, what do you think about iOS apps running on the Mac? Because that's, of course, a very interesting side effect of Apple now switching to ARM and to switching to their own Apple Silicon-powered Macs is something that we didn't really expect, but now users will be able to directly install apps from the iOS App Store on their Macs, like unmodified. And this, for me, was kind of funny because we've spent so many years now in the Apple developer community talking about what makes a good Mac app, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is this app Mac-like? First, there was these like Electron-based apps and web apps. And then later with the Catalyst and Marzipan, before it was Catalyst, there was all this talk about like iOS kind of conventions coming over as part of that. And Apple was like, hold my beer. Now we're going to run apps more or less unmodified. They're doing a little bit of kind of translations here and there and translating like settings bundles into preferences windows and things like that. But more or less, these apps will run unmodified on the Mac. And yeah, what do you think about that? What do you think about the fact that now iOS is really, really kind of coming over to the Mac for real?
Yeah, it's interesting because that's something I thought about when the rumors started picking up about Apple releasing the ARM Macs. And I thought about this, like, will we be able to run iOS apps on the Mac? And my internal conclusion was that they have to do something about it, otherwise someone else will, like, right. You know, they are the same architecture, they have pretty much all the same frameworks. Someone would make iOS apps run on the Mac if Apple did not. So I think they did the right thing, and you're going to just launch the Mac App Store and search for an iOS app and install it, basically. And they did a little demo of a game running from iOS, and it's going to run in a window if it's an iOS app, if it's an iPhone app, because, well, it's an iPhone app, so it wasn't really designed to be resized in such a way. But iPad apps, I guess, will have more flexibility. But yeah, I think it's good. I've never been too much into the, oh, Catalyst is awful and these are not real Mac apps. My problem with Electron, which people know I'm not a huge fan of Electron, but even with Electron, like, if you look at Visual Studio Code, which is an Electron app, it's amazing. Like, it's really good. So I think even with something like Electron, if you want to make a really good job, you can. And I think the same goes for Catalyst. And of course, these iOS apps running unmodified, they're not going to be even as good as a Catalyst app, presumably, because the developer doesn't even know necessarily that their app is running on a Mac. Yeah. But I think it's better than not having the app. Like, how many times I've been here on my Mac working and I get a message from someone on Instagram or something, and I just really want to open a window on my Mac and reply to the message, and I can't because there isn't a Mac app for Instagram and the website doesn't have DMs. At least it did not. Apparently now they're adding it. But anyway, it would be great for me to just launch Instagram on my Mac. It doesn't matter that it's going to be a window. It's not going to be perfect, but I'm going to be able to reply to the message. So I think thumbs up for that. I think that's a huge deal. And just to clarify something that some people aren't very clear on, developers are going to have the option to opt out of this. So I think right after the announcement, some people were under the impression that you wouldn't have an option. Like, if you have an iOS app, it's going to be on the Mac. So developers will be able to opt out. Like, there are some iOS apps that probably don't make any sense on the Mac. So it makes sense for developers to have that power to decide if their app is going to run on the Mac.
Yeah, like camera apps and AR apps and things like that, where you don't even have the device capabilities or things that use the phone or anything that requires capabilities in the hardware that is unique to iOS devices.
Yeah, and presumably that's also going to be automatic, like for things such as ARKit and telephony. I think the App Store is going to filter those out automatically, which already happens for the iPod Touch. If you have an app that requires telephony, I think like WhatsApp is not available for the iPod Touch because it requires telephony and it's not there. So I think that that's going to be fine. And if you have an iOS app, let's say, this is never going to happen, but let's say Instagram decides to make a Mac app and their iOS app has been running on the Mac and you have their iOS app installed. If they release it as a universal app, which is the way to go these days, you are going to just get an update and you're going to have the Mac app then.
That's super cool.
And the iOS app will cease to exist on the Mac. I think that's a really seamless update. So developers don't need to worry, but I'm thinking about making a Mac app. So if my users download the iOS app, it's not going to work. And also, if you are a developer and you have a Mac app already for your iOS app, you can just uncheck the checkbox and it's your iOS app is not going to show up in the Mac App Store.
Yeah, it feels like they really, really thought this through, and it seems to be an elegant way to do all of this because, like you mentioned, the goal here, it seems like from Apple's perspective and also from kind of user's perspective, is to get an app that wasn't even available at all. And I think for a couple of different categories, this will be particularly important. And I'm thinking about three main ones right now off the top of my head. Messaging apps, like you mentioned also, like Instagram, WhatsApp, and things like that, where you weren't able to use them natively on the Mac before, like you can with iMessage, and now you will be able to do that, which I think will be really, really useful. And also, again, it doesn't really matter then that they're just running in a small little window, because usually when I use iMessage, I also just keep it as a small little window.
Yep.
Like, I don't run iMessage full screen on my Mac, you know?
Same.
I run most apps full screen on my Mac, but not messages. And I also think media consumption apps like, you know, HBO, Netflix, things like that will be also huge, where you don't have to use a website like an animal and you can instead use a native app, which presumably will be very, very nice. And finally, games, like you also mentioned. Games, I think, will be a huge category because there are so many games available for iOS. And now, also with the game controller framework that was added a few years ago, and there was a really cool session at WWDC, which we can put a link to in the show notes, where they demonstrated how you can use that same game controller framework to also enable keyboard controls. And presumably those will also translate over to the Mac automatically. So if you have a game that supports game controllers with either no work on the developer's part or very little work on the developer's part, you will be able to play those games with a keyboard and mouse, which is fantastic, right? That's really, really nice, both for iPad Pro with a keyboard. I've been wanting to play so many games on the iPad Pro with the keyboard attachment, and to also be able to play them on the Mac. So I am also very much in favor of this. I think that what makes a Mac app has kind of been blurred over the last few years, and some people are more upset about that than others. I kind of think it mostly comes down to expectations. Like, if an app looks like a native app, it looks like a real Mac app, and you can't like hit Command N to create a new document, like that's weird. But that's also kind of changing on iOS as well, with, again, keyboard support on the iPad. There's much richer support now for keyboard events and keyboard command APIs and things like SwiftUI now. So I think we have to maybe give it a few more years still, but eventually I think most of these things will kind of work themselves out, and you will be able to use all the Mac behaviors that you would expect, and those would also work the same way or equivalent ways on iOS as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a matter of time before things get better. And you can see that with Catalyst, which got big improvements in the new macOS release, and also it's related to iOS, of course, with the new game controller and keyboard and mouse capture things. And I've been running Big Sur on my secondary Mac here, and iMessage is just great. Like, it's really good, and I don't feel like I'm using something different. Like, I don't use it thinking like, oh, I'm using this iPad app and it's weird. No, I don't have that feeling at all. It's really, really good.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't tried out the beta yet, but I'm really looking forward to it because it does seem like so many nice additions, and especially messages I'm really, really looking forward to. So related to all of this is, of course, the new design language also that we mentioned earlier before the lightning storm started. But let's go into a little bit more detail around what we think about the new design language in macOS Big Sur, because I feel like all the things we're discussing here, iPhone and iPad apps running on the Mac, Catalyst, cross-platform development with things like Swift UI, it's all kind of coming together with this design refresh because, like we mentioned, the platforms are moving closer together, both in terms of their underlying technology and with the systems on a chip, but also now in terms of the user interface as well. So since you've been running the Big Sur beta now for a few days, what do you think about the new design language?
I like it. I think it's more in line with the current design trends that we've been seeing in other Apple platforms. I love the new control center, which is SwiftUI, by the way, which is kind of cool. The widgets are also SwiftUI, and they're also really cool. Something that's especially nice about the new control center is how you can drag controls from control center into your menu bar and they become little icons. So let's say you use Do Not Disturb a lot, which I do. So I can open Control Center, drag the Do Not Disturb icon to the menu bar, and now I have a persistent Do Not Disturb control on my menu bar. I think that's a really nice touch and very Mac-like. Things are more rounded. There's a hideous battery icon in preferences, but
I love how everyone is pointing out that particular icon. I kind of feel bad for the designer who made it, because I'm sure it was one of those things where, you know, oh, we haven't made that icon yet. Can you just like quickly make it? Like, no one will probably notice. And then like everyone is pointing out this icon. I hope they fix that.
they probably will. I think that they've got quite a bit of feedback about that one.
So that's
a minor thing. But overall, like, it's really good. And even running apps, something that happened this year that I find kind of interesting, I'd love to know the backstory on it. So if there are any birdies out there listening, please contact me. But something something that happened this year that's a little bit different that I noticed is they don't seem to be doing as much linkage checking on apps in order to adopt new behaviors. So it used to be in all of the previous years, and this could very well be a beta one thing. So forgive me if in beta 2 this completely changes, but it's usually like it usually works like this. If you have, and this works for both the Mac and iOS, if you have an app that's been linked against the previous SDK, you're not going to get some of the more extreme new looks and behaviors applied to your app, because your app was not designed and developed with that in mind, so it's more prone to breaking if the system changes from under your app, basically. And it didn't happen this year. Like, they are applying the new looks and the new behaviors of the new stuff in Big Sur to all apps, even apps that haven't been linked against the new SDK.
It could be something with the underlying implementation of things like the Windows Server, right? Mm-hmm. Where, as far as I know, the Windows Server is this persistent process that runs on the Mac, and it kind of manages all the windows and renders them. And then the content inside of the window is kind of rendered by the app, right? So it could be something like that, where it was too complicated, or it yielded too many weird side effects to have both of the appearances kind of rendered at the same time, something like that?
Yeah, but I'm not talking just about appearances, which it does make sense what you mentioned, but even things such as the new sidebar, that when you have certain items in a certain configuration in your toolbar, your toolbar becomes split as well with the sidebar. Even that is being applied, and that's a behavior thing. It's not like a visual thing. So,
right.
And I've seen some of the same stuff on iOS, but I don't have an example to give right now. So, yeah, I thought that was really interesting that they aren't doing as much, at least, linkage checks for previous SDKs. That's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. It's funny because we just mentioned earlier on this episode how we feel like Apple with this release, and especially with the Apple Silicon stuff, is kind of, you know, doing more in terms of backwards compatibility and to make sure that everything keeps working. But this is an example of the opposite. So maybe it's just like a missing check in the first beta. Like, we don't know. But yeah, it would be interesting if they automatically opt all the apps into the new behaviors by default.
Yeah, but actually, to their credit, I haven't seen many apps break in horrible ways. Like, there are some visual glitches and things like that, but nothing like major. So maybe this was intentional because they did some testing and they noticed that it wouldn't be required because most apps would just work.
Right, exactly. So Rambo, the new design language in macOS Big Sur has been a source of quite a lot of speculation in the community over the past days and the past week, where it seems like there's a lot of theories around what this new design language might mean for the future of the Mac, or for even maybe new Apple products that haven't yet been released yet. So can you talk a little bit about that and also what your thoughts around this are?
Yeah, so Big Sur has more rounded corners, which is always better, in my opinion. But Mac displays are square. They don't have rounded corners. And kind of looks like they want to make sure they look good if eventually we get Macs with rounded corners in their displays. And NSView now has safe areas as well.
Yeah, which is the API that is used on the iPhone X and the new iPads to check where it's safe to draw controls and things like that in regards to the home indicator and the notch and things like that.
Yeah, and also rounded corners.
Right.
So I think there is an excuse for that. Like, I've seen an explanation, but of course, an explanation can be given and it cannot be the full story. But I do think that since they're moving to their own silicon, and of course, it's not, it might not happen this year. Maybe this year's Macs with their chips are going to look more or less like the Macs we know today, except for the internals. But who knows, like, they might be working on some really cool new Mac designs that we didn't even think about. And also, the spacing between things and the increased size for some controls, and even the addition of a large variant for most UI controls in AppKit, kind of makes me wonder if they're trying to make the Mac UI more touch-friendly. It definitely has a little bit of that in there. And this doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, Apple is going to release a Mac with a touchscreen, which I think many people would actually like. But I don't think that that's something that necessarily means that. But it could mean something like they want Sidecar to be better and they want you to actually be able to interact with apps in Sidecar. Or it could mean something like an iMac where you can like adjust the display angle and draw with an Apple Pencil and manipulate things with your fingers. I don't know. I think some designers out there would love that. So I think there is enough stuff in there that we can speculate that new Mac hardware is going to look a little bit different.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think what might end up happening is if you look right now, if you just take the iPad and the Mac, you take those are two kind of categories of products. And when you hear something like this, your first thought might be, okay, Apple might release something where you take the iPad Pro and the keyboard, but you like put them together into one package, and that's a smaller touch capable laptop, right? Running Mac OS. But what I think might end up happening, this is just a wild theory, but imagine not just having two categories like that, but rather like a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Where you have many different products where their capabilities range from, here's a kind of Mac Pro tower, which is just the computer and the Mac Mini as well, where you connect it to a display, use a keyboard and mouse, and that's like your classic desktop Mac, right? Your desktop computer. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the iPad, right? Or like fully touch capable. If you want to add like a keyboard or a pointing device, you do that externally. It's not something that is kind of built into the hardware itself. But then you have that range where the iMac product that you mentioned, where it's like you can use it as this kind of drafting table, right? You can use it as a drawing, big, big drawing tablet with a screen like the Microsoft Studio they released a few years ago. I think that's something that could be incredibly cool, where the computers are not necessarily just like, here is this particular form factor, but rather here is a larger range of different capabilities. And if you want like a thin computer with lots of battery life, it has just a keyboard and a screen, you can buy that. If you want a laptop where you can have touch capabilities, which might be a little bit heavier or thicker, you can buy that. If you just want the iPad and you can add peripherals as you wish, you can buy that. You know, like you can pick which capabilities you want, and you can have a larger kind of range of hardware. What do you think about something like that?
Yeah, I think that would make sense, and it would be definitely good for people who want something different. I'm just super excited about what's going to be unveiled later this year. I was thinking like, oh, Apple is going to release an iMac, and I think many people are still thinking like, ah, oh, it's going to be like a replacement for the 12-inch MacBook, like if you want to do some light text editing or web browsing. I'm not thinking that anymore. I'm thinking we're going to see some pretty beefy Macs later this year. And I'm excited with the possibility that I could even replace my 16-inch MacBook Pro with whatever they release later this year. So I'm looking forward to it.
All of the demos during WWDC tell me one thing, and that's that they're incredibly proud of this, and they kind of want to show off just how powerful these things are. Because they didn't talk much about, like, battery life, right? They didn't talk about, let's make the thinnest product possible or something like that. They talked about sheer performance. They were like, here are the beefiest of apps, like Final Cut Pro, and here is Photoshop running an emulation. Like, that's what they were showing. So all kind of signs point towards that they're going to use this to really, like, create really powerful Macs. Not necessarily let's make them the same performance, but thinner and lighter and more battery life. Maybe that product will exist as well, but it does really seem like they want to create the most powerful thing you've ever seen. And I am also really, really excited about that.
Yeah, one thing that we need to keep in mind is that we don't know what the Mac chips are going to be like. We don't.
Right.
They haven't said anything about them. We know that Apple's chips are great and super powerful, and the A12Z is screaming on that DTK. We shouldn't know it, but we do. And I've seen some tests that people have done, and it's crazy. Like, it... And it's an iPad chip. It's not, they are not even trying. That's, I think, what Craig said. So
yeah,
imagine what the Mac chip is going to be like. I really hope they don't disappoint us, because I always try to keep my expectations low, but I can't help myself this time.
Yeah, same. All right, so I think this is a good point to end this episode. Again, we are not nearly done discussing all of the things from WWDC. There are so many more things to talk about. I think both of us really want to talk more in detail about Swift UI and cross-platform development and just how much of a big upgrade this year is in terms of Swift UI's API, and also many, many other things as well. So, of course, stay tuned. Let us know what you thought about this episode. Send us your Ask Stacktrace questions, because we haven't done any questions now on the previous couple of episodes, but we will definitely do that starting next week. So if you have any WWDC-related questions for either me or Rambo, just tweet them with the hashtag AskStackTrace, and we're going to answer as many of them as we possibly can. But that's it for this episode. So thanks so much for listening. Talk to you again in 1 week, and say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye. Just hang on, I really have to go close the window because, like, the world is ending outside.
Sure.
Just a moment. I shouldn't have mentioned adaptive lightning, because I think that's exactly what's happening right now. Like,
you summoned the adaptive lightning.
It's completely black outside and it's 4 p.m.
Siri heard, hey, I heard you wanted some lightning. Here's some lightning for you.
Okay, let's keep going. What did you just say? Oh, now power went out. Now it's back. And now it's out again.
But you have a laptop and you have 4G now, so it's okay. Everything's okay.
This is the best recording ever.
We keep podcasting till the end of the world.
Okay, let's go before my battery dies.
The end of the world, brought to you live by Stacktrace. Except it will be released after the world has already ended. So,
okay, keep going.